Welcome to the War and Diplomacy podcast, produced by the Centre for War and Diplomacy at Lancaster University. The CWD provides the historical context and strategic analysis to inform understanding of today's geopolitical challenges, promoting discussion through research, teaching, consultancy, and public events.
Hello, I'm Thomas Mills and I'm lecturer in Diplomatic and International History at Lancaster University and Deputy Director of the Centre for War and Diplomacy. I'm delighted to be joined by Gaynor Johnson. Gaynor has been Professor of International History at the University of Kent since 2013. She sits on the executive boards of the British International History Group and the Transatlantic Studies Association and was previously Book Reviews Editor for the International History Review. She's also an honorary researcher at the Centre for War and Diplomacy. Gaynor has published widely in the field of international history on topics ranging from fanaticism and warfare to interwar appeasement. She led a major AHRC project on British and French attitudes towards European integration between 1919 and 1957. A major preoccupation of her work has been the study of diplomacy and diplomats. She has published studies of Robert Cecil, Eric Phipps, and Lord Davenant, to name but a few. She has also explored the often overlooked role of civil servants in the formulation of foreign policy, including the role of women in the British Foreign Office. She has adopted innovative methodological approaches to the study of diplomatic history, including the use of prosopography. We're going to explore how Gaynor has used some of these methodologies in her work in our conversation today. Welcome, Gaynor.
Thank you very much.
Before we come on to the idea of prosopography as an approach to diplomatic history, if you could just tell us a bit about your general research interests, how you became a historian interested in diplomacy.
Okay, well, my starting point of my research goes right back to when I was an undergraduate, and I went to a lecture as a first year on 1920s diplomacy. And one of the things that came out of that was this idea of the 1920s being a unique or different kind of a decade that's often overlooked by historians of the interwar period, who are more interested in thinking about the rise of Hitler, the rise of fascism, the origins of the Second World War, things like that. And I decided that if I ever had the chance to do research in history, that I would try and spend some time looking at the 1920s. And so my doctoral research was on a chap called Lord Davenant, who was British ambassador to Berlin after the First World War. And that kind of led me into the world of ambassadorial diplomacy, thinking about the impact that an individual could have on Britain's relations with another power, how very personal their kind of interaction is with the foreign governments and with the Foreign Office and so on. And I also came to realise that relatively little had been written about these people. There were a few but major studies, but most of them hadn't been studied. So from that, I developed an interest in not just Britain's ambassadorial relations with Germany, but also thinking about the same kind of relationship with France and the United States and so on. And that led to an interest in the institution, of course, that appoints them and to whom they report, which, of course, is the Foreign Office. So that was a kind of second strand to my research. But for most of my career, I've spent writing about the Foreign Office very much from what you might call the perspective of the ruling elites or the governing elites, which are the foreign secretary, the senior civil servants. But more recently, I've been thinking about even the wider context of the Foreign Office within the British government, within the infrastructure in Whitehall. And from that, thinking about the entirety of the Foreign Office, the kinds of people who work there, not just the kinds of people we hear about in the historical record, but people like civil servants and also women, because I was very impressed by Helen McCarthy's work on women in the world, her book Women in the World, which talks about the evolution of the role of women from what you might call the kind of social role that they had accompanying their husbands on diplomatic missions to becoming diplomats in their own right in during the course of the 20th century. And so I thought a little bit about that. But I thought, well, actually, there are other women who are involved in diplomacy, and we never hear about them. And they are the clerks and typists and other people who perform these, what you might call supporting roles, but nevertheless very important roles, and that we knew absolutely nothing about them, even though periodically they are very occasionally, they're referred to. And I thought, well, how can we know more about them? And I remember looking through the literature, and the things that the first place I really noticed that they had any kind of biographical place was in the Foreign Office list, which is produced annually. I decided that I was going to see what I could extract from that. And then when I went through that, the project that this talk is linked to covers the period between 1920 and 1960, which is quite a long period, a period of several generations, I noticed that within the Foreign Office lists, more and more of these women become visible. They become, we know more and more about them. But what do we know about them? And what I found out was basically we knew their name. We very often know their date of birth, and we know a little bit about their posts, where they were sent to, the kinds of roles they occupied. But this is very, very sketchy. It is literally just a few facts and figures. And so I thought, well, it's not enough to be able on as individuals. It's not enough for us to be able to kind of draw many conclusions. But how else can we find out more about them, and what are there other ways by which we can draw conclusions? And that was why I decided to use a methodology which many people today would see as being to do with social science, which is the use of prosopography in the study of women.
So if we just, this is probably a term that some people have heard, some people haven't. It's been around for some time, but it's maybe not been integrated into the kind of mainstream of history, if you like. So can we just stand back a bit, and can you tell us what prosopography is?
What prosopography is, apart from a very difficult word to say, it's known in different ways, actually. It's really classical scholars that refer to prosopography. We perhaps as modern historians may be more comfortable with the phrase collective biography. So basically what you do with prosopography is, or collective biography, is to put together a body of data. So I was talking about the women clerks, the women typists in the Foreign Office, about whom we know maybe their date of birth, we know a little bit about their career. But if you were to put together as much information as you can find about as many of those people you can find, you can perhaps start to deduce areas of common ground between them. One thing that I did in addition to looking at the Foreign Office list was to use online genealogical websites. So, the ones that are commercially available. And so I researched individual women. So from that, I was able to find out not just the year they were born, but where they were born. I was able to find out about their parents. I was able to find out where they lived, where they went to school, if they married, and when they died. So suddenly the world opens up if you use that that kind of data. And you can draw, some really, I think, really important and interesting general conclusions from that when you look at these, look at these women. In my article, I say I came at the subject with a number of really kind of preconceived ideas. One of them was that because most of the women who were part of the diplomatic service came from upper middle class backgrounds, came from quite what we would today would perhaps see as being well-heeled, privately educated ladies, I assume that the secretarial classes in an institution like the Foreign Office would be the same. And it's not. They're very often women from lower middle class backgrounds, but sometimes from extremely diverse backgrounds. I did find a number of ladies who were quite from quite well-heeled posh backgrounds, if you will. But I also found some women who, if you chase their origins, they were actually born in the workhouse. So they were, you know, very, very kind of humble origins. But of course, how do they get to work together? They get to work together because they pass the entrance exams to the civil service, because they have the requisite intelligence, the requisite practical skills. They can type, they may have languages of different kinds, French and German in particular. So they're able to compete on an equal footing. And so we tend to think of the Foreign Office as being institutionally quite elite, maybe snobbish, very introverted in its culture. And yet you have this group of women, and it's not just women, but also men who are civil servants as well. It's much more democratic. It's much more inclusive, as we would say today, in its recruitment and in its approach. I also found that a number of these women had what you call more opportunities career-wise than you might expect. So a woman might be appointed to the Foreign Office as a clerical assistant, which is a fairly low grade general clerical position. But during the course of her career, she may very well end up being given a consular position abroad. So there's not only a sense of job opportunities for a wider group of people to work within the Foreign Service, but you've also got a certain amount of flexibility within the career structure for them. I haven't found any examples of a woman who comes in as a clerk and ends up as an ambassador. We haven't got that kind of full range of the spectrum, but we do have quite a lot of examples of women, particularly in the 50s and 60s, who do aspire to having these kinds of consular roles particularly.
That's fascinating. For people who are not familiar with the kind of workings of the Foreign Office, you've given an indication of kind of where, what level women can come in at,
yes,
the kind of things that they went on to do. What, just a little bit more specifically, what were they doing in the Foreign Office? What were the primary tasks that they were doing? What did it mean to be a clerk in the Foreign Office in the period you're looking at? And then what else did they go on and do? How did they go up the ranks?
Okay, well, in terms of the kinds of work, they basically fell into two groups when they were appointed. Some of them did general clerical work. So that would be filing, taking minutes at meetings, maybe writing letters for ambassadors or more senior officials. And you also had people who were typists, who obviously had typing skills. Many of them had could do shorthand typing. So they had their own career structures and their own pay structures in that kind of world, if you like. They also had the opportunity to cross over to each other, so you could train as a typist. There's a lot of in-house training, and there was also in-house training in languages. One of the things, in fact, was a desirable attribute to any of the clerical staff, whether it's an ordinary clerk or whether you were a typist, if you had a foreign language, particularly, as I mentioned before, French and German. And later on in the 1940s, the entrance exams for clerical staff for the Foreign Office included a test in those languages. So you couldn't kind of, you know, sort of fudge it. You had to be able to have those skills. So you have that kind of I think in the article I talk about them as being traditional secretarial work, which we associate even in a generic context with women rather than men occupying those roles. Now, the women who kind of moved on to occupying a kind of say a consular role, two things seem to have in common. One is that they remain single. They don't marry. So they, if you are career civil servants, so they sacrifice, if you will, marriage and children and family life for pursuing their career. They were also women who are willing and able to travel. So they're not necessarily, not only are they not married, but they perhaps don't have caring responsibilities for parents or siblings or any other kind of family members. So they go abroad. Now, consular work then and today is very often the kind of what you might call the unglamorous day-to-day work of a diplomat or of the role of an embassy. So, for example, if we were to go on holiday and we were to lose our passport, it would go to talk to the consular department of the embassy, who would then sort you out with paperwork to get you home. So a lot of it is kind of mundane, basic, day-to-day dealing with the community of tourists or businessmen from that country who may need assistance of whatever kind. And so my argument about the role of the women in this is some of the women join the lower ranks of that consular service. And what is said about them is, because so much of it is dealing with people, they're seen, because they're women, they're seen as having good people skills, good kind of communication and an ability to empathise with that tourist who's lost his passport or whatever it might be. Not the kind of big boy diplomacy stuff, negotiating treaties and all that kind of thing. So, I mean, there is a kind of slightly condescending element to this, and I'm saying my study ends in 1960. So what the role of the position is now is not something I can really say, but those were kinds of the conclusions that I drew.
And thank you for that. That's interesting to look at the consular side of diplomacy. In the article, you also talk about locally established clerks.
Yes,
That's an overseas posting that was open to women as well, was it?
Yes, it was. It could be an overseas posting. You could be dispatched off from Whitehall to wherever it is, anywhere in the world you might want to mention. But very often, more often, they were what you might call part of the local expatriate community. So there might be people who. I think in the examples that I found, they were the wives or widows of people who had gone out to that country to work on business or whatever. And I think you particularly see this with widowed ladies, because it becomes a source of income. And they're important because they very often speak the local language, which is obviously always massively helpful. But they're also well connected. They're trusted. They have a good local network of intelligence, information, and so on. So that's a kind of strand that I think in itself would make an interesting study separately.
So, I mean, it does sound like in many respects the Foreign Office was willing to sort of break down some of these gender barriers in terms of employing women in these roles, often very important roles. You mentioned in terms of clerks and typists, there were male clerks and typists as well. Am I right in thinking they didn't work together? Were they kind of segregated, if you like? Or
There were occasions where, certainly when women clerks started to become more evident in the 1920s and 1930s, there are some very amusing stories actually about the need to segregate the male and female clerks, and very often the segregation was very primitive, like sticking a curtain up in the middle of a room and saying the men on one side and the women on the other. And there was a genuine belief widely held within Whitehall that having men and women working in the same physical space would be distracting, that they would be kind of, flirting with each other and kind of not being terribly professional in their interactions. So it had to be kept separate. And also there was a certain amount of hierarchy where the idea that a lot of this clerical work, typing work, was deemed to be inferior. So it was deemed to be kind of, women's work. So it was kept segregated. plus the fact typists were universally women, and also the typing pool was an incredibly noisy place. So putting them somewhere physically separate was also had, you know, kind of more practical, sensible, practical attributes. But in terms of the way they were treated within the civil service, from what I've been able to deduce, they were treated in exactly the same way, with one exception, and that was the so-called marriage bar. Mm-hmm. Which meant that, and that was in, that actually remained in place until the 1970s, where women were hired usually about the age of 17 or 18 and worked for a few years. Very often, most of them got married when they were 21, 22. So they worked for, say, 3 or 4 years and then they would leave. And the idea was that the very traditional view that women didn't work, married women didn't work, and should go off to look after their husbands. So that view of women, actually, women clerks, was something that changed in the 1950s, where women were allowed to come back part-time if they were married. There was it was kind of finessed a bit more. But my research found that a lot of the women remained unmarried throughout their lives, died old maids, if you will. But some of them also married when they retired. So you see, because I've looked through their marriage records, you suddenly see a lady retiring at the age of 60, which is the retirement age for most of them. And, you know, when she's 60, 61, she marries. You also see actually that with clerks, with male clerks as well. It's not just something you see with women, although there was no marriage bar for male clerks. So it's almost as though they devote their energies to their career. And then in their old age, as it were, their retirement, they want that kind of companionship or whatever that they might be seeking. And I would love to know, you know, how far some of these relationships were perhaps pursued over many years, and only kind of, you know, they came together to get married maybe after that point of retirement. Mm. So
yeah,
can't really tell that. Mm.
The marriage bar, so you said it was modified in the 1950s, but yeah. Is it 1972?
It was removed
right at
the time of the, you know, there was a great liberalisation of British society at the time of sex discrimination became illegal and those kinds of things that existed. Yeah.
Yeah. And you said about women staying on in the jobs until older age and possibly marrying afterwards. But was one effect of the marriage bar to mean that most of the women doing these kind of clerical jobs were quite young? Or?
Yes. Yeah, they were.
Okay, yeah. Yep.
And most of them had short careers. Most of them had short careers. You also have not just the marriage bar, but one thing that I found in the Foreign Office is a lot of their letters of resignation. So you see the reasons, and a lot of them, if they marry, they're in order to resign and get their civil service pension, they have to send in a copy of their marriage certificate. So that kind of level of bureaucracy. Mm.
Yeah, I was just wondering again about the sort of gender relations a little bit. So you talked about this perceived need for segregating men and women working. I mean, do you have any sense of what did the men in the Foreign Office think of these women? Do you have a kind of sense of how they were viewed?
I think that there was a general sense that women's work was women's work. If you look at in the period between 1920 and 1960, there's something like 4 or 5 different royal commissions on the civil service, not just the Foreign Office, but the civil service in general, about its recruitment policies, its culture, and so on. And throughout that, firstly, the Foreign Office always tries to make a case for being exceptional. Their work is unusual and usually important, and they're very keen on retaining their kind of elite position within the government hierarchy. Another thing that they tend to do, of course, is try and find, it's a very much a male dominated elite, and they resist tooth and nail the role of women, an increased role of women. And you have all sorts of arguments made. There was 1929, there was a royal commission called the Tomlin Commission, which was on the civil service on its entirety. And one of the things it suggested, it recommended, was not only that women should have diplomatic roles, full-time, you know, permanent diplomatic roles, but that they should have the same opportunities as men. Well, this met with absolute horror within the senior civil servants within the Foreign Office. And they came up with all sorts of reasons why women were not suitable to be sent off to these major diplomatic roles. And, you know, some of it was kind of legitimate in the sense that culturally, a woman being sent to, say, an Arab country might be seen as being controversial, and as it would still be today to lead a diplomatic mission. There was a culture also that believed that to send a woman to represent the British government as a head of mission was to say, well, you're only sending a woman. You don't take her seriously enough to send a man. So there's that kind of dimension to it. There's also the sense that, I mean, silly things like, you know, women wouldn't cope with hot countries, wouldn't cope with the climate so well as a man in hot countries. So there's those kinds of notions. But it's interesting to note, though, that the civil service itself as an entity in the 1920s and 1930s was very keen on promoting what we would call, you know, equal opportunities, gender equality and equal opportunities for both sexes. Yes.
So there were clear limits on the role of women in the Foreign Office in the period you're looking at, and real resistance to their advancement. This is a slightly broader question and maybe a difficult one to answer, but there's talk in increasingly there's a kind of gendered approach to the study of foreign policy, maybe more in politics, international relations, the social sciences, but in history as well. Mm-hmm. Do you think you can say that the presence of women working in these roles as typists, as clerks, in sometimes in more senior roles, do you think it shaped, did it change the way that British foreign policy functioned? Was there a kind of gendered dimension, do you think, to foreign policy as a result of women doing these kind of roles?
I think it's harder to detect in the period that I've worked on. I think you probably see the beginnings of it. I think there were women who were active in diplomacy during the period that I work on. I mentioned that the consular officials, but people like, for example, Freya Stark, who I talk about in the article, but they're seen as being very unusual and very exceptional and really a bit eccentric. They're not seen as being typical of anything, including their own sex. But I think as you get into the period after the merger of the Colonial Office and the Foreign Office, after the late 60s and into the 1970s, the way in which foreign policy is run by the British government immediately becomes much more diverse in all sorts of ways. So you get, you know, it's more ethnically diverse, it's there's greater gender diversity. So I think it's something that's advancing as we go along. One of the things that I'm looking at the moment, I'm interested in at the moment, is looking at the number of women who occupy the post of ambassador today. And it's interesting to see which countries have female ambassadors, heads of mission from Britain. And the most, probably the headline one, it was most recently, was Dame Janet Pierce, who became ambassador to Washington. Mm-hmm. The idea that, I mean, the Washington embassy was seen as being is seen by many people as being the plum embassy, and that a woman should hold that post. And it's, you know, it's interesting to see that we now have an ambassador, a female ambassador to Germany. We haven't had a female ambassador yet to France. What that tells us is perhaps something that needs to be explored more by scholars. There's an ever increasing number of women occupying those roles. And I know that there are a number of scholars out there who have interviewed them and are interviewing them. And, you know, so it's a line of inquiry that is being pursued, not necessarily completely by myself, but by other people.
So things are changing, and certainly changed since the period you were studying, but okay. There's still marked differences in the overall numbers and the seniority, I would imagine, of women serving in the British Foreign Office. If we could just finish with one or two questions about the kind of broader implications of this kind of approach, this kind of methodological approach in international diplomatic history. So you gave a paper, I think it was at Glasgow University, and one of the things you said was that the use of prosopography through this kind of collective biography allows scholars in the area of international history to kind of embrace what's been called the cultural turn in history. So you see it as a kind of bridge between these kind of different fields, this kind of elite-based diplomatic history and the sort of societal, cultural-based form of history. Can you just explain a little bit what you mean by that, how you see this kind of approach serving that function?
Yes, I see it in terms of providing, just like any biography, whether, you know, it's a biography that any of us would have on our bookshelves, provides by definition an analysis of the life and times of an individual person. And I think that this prosopographic approach provides a way of providing human detail, humanizes people about whom we probably otherwise would not know very much. You know, I found a lot out about my female clerks, but I haven't yet found, for example, private papers. We don't have that level of detail, which we would have if we were perhaps studying sort of the British ambassador to Berlin, like Lord Davenant, for example. I think it gives a human dimension. I think it also enables us to look at changing attitudes towards relations between states. The fact that it's now considered acceptable for a female head of mission to be appointed, and that it's not considered, if you look at the Foreign Office website, it's not considered strange or unique anymore. It's just announced as if anything, it was just a routine appointment kind of thing. So I think this approach allows us to think, to get to know people individually and to know more about their working environment. That perhaps, and also for us to examine people who perhaps otherwise would be overlooked.
Yeah, so it gives that human dimension, but also uncovering people who wouldn't get biographies written on them in the kind of elite setting. Well, I think it's fascinating, and it's an area of international diplomatic history that needs much more thought and conversation given to it. And I'm really grateful for you, Gaynor, for sharing your insights that you've gained from the work you're doing in that area. So we're out of time. So it just remains to say, thank you very much for joining me today, Gaynor, and for providing these kind of insights into prosopography as a way to study diplomatic history and into the role of women that you've been looking at in the Foreign Office. So Gaynor's article, Women Clerks and Typists in the British Foreign Office, 1920 to 1960, A Prosopographic Study, will be out in Diplomacy and Statecraft in December 2020. Her biography of Lord Robert Cecil is published by Ashgate and is available from all respectable booksellers. Thank you very much for listening, and do be sure to check out other CWD podcasts. Goodbye for now.
Thank you for listening. To hear further podcasts, please visit the CWD website, lancaster.ac.uk/CWD. There you can find more on the CWD's research, events and teaching, including the MA in International and Military History.